Hey guys, it's Jill. Jen and I wanted to give you a heads up about the content on today's episode. It may be triggering for more sensitive audiences. Refer to the show notes for more specifics. And take care while you listen. On this episode of Common Mystics, we give voice to one family still seeking closure for their senseless and horrific murders that occurred in 1851. I'm Jennifer James.
I'm Jill Stanley.
We're psychics.
We're sisters.
We are Common Mystics. We find extraordinary stories in ordinary places. And today's story takes us to Kent County, Maryland.
Hi.
Hi.
The story is horrific. It's terrible. So you guys, honestly, it's the worst case scenario squared. It's so bad.
We happened upon this area when we were traveling out east in the Delaware, Maryland area, remember?
This is our last story from that road trip. So let's remind everyone of our intentions as we were leaving Smyrna, Delaware.
We asked the spirits to lead us to a verifiable story previously unknown to us that allowed us to give voice to the voiceless.
That's right. And as we were heading west out of Smyrna, Delaware, we ended up in Maryland, and I was feeling a house of horrors, not like a haunted house, but literally in my mind's eye, I saw blood on the walls the way it was depicted in the Amityville horror movie when the walls were like bleeding.
Ooh.
That's never good.
Right.
Never good if your house bleeds.
I was seeing a woman who was crying out, like outside in a field, crying out, afraid for her children.
Not good. Not good. I can hear gunfire in my head. But not like rapid gunfire, like boom, boom, gunfire.
And I was feeling a farm, a family on a farm.
You were looking for a farmhouse.
I was looking for a farmhouse, and you were looking for a clearing in the woods.
There was a rendezvous point in the woods that I knew people met at. So it was all, again, random, but you write it down and piece these things together.
Mm-hmm.
We stopped at a rando little cemetery off the side of the highway. Do you remember?
I do. I do. It was very, very old, and we ended up talking to a man there.
There was a little old man caretaker, and he walks around. He makes sure that the stones are straight.
He told us about the possibility that some of the stones had been lost over time.
About the number of graves and how he didn't really know because some of the stones may have been lost to time. Yep.
Exactly. So we drove into Galena, Maryland.
Yes. And Jennifer wanted me to go towards a church called St. Denis Church. She was pulled to St. Denis Church. Now, you know that her husband, Dennis, who is the notorious ghost block, he's not named after this church.
He is not.
Not the same Dennis. No relations.
A church seemed very significant to this story, and I was also pulled south.
Yes. But we had to get back because we've been in the car, and yeah. I was like, yo, we need to go north. And I said to you, we're not going to find anything south.
Also, Bohemia kept coming to mind.
You noticed the Bohemia RV. It was like a dealership, and you circled Bohemia in your notes, and you had a question mark. Like, why does that seem significant?
Why am I so psychic right now?
Why are you so stupid psychic? It doesn't even make sense.
The funny thing is you did this outline, and I didn't even realize that until just now. Like,
really?
That is crazy.
Yeah. Look at your notes.
Jesus.
Anyway, so this isn't the importance. We talk about journaling. This is why it's important.
That's true. That's true, because I can't remember.
While we were driving through town, and I had to pull you away to head you back to the north of us, because that's where we were staying. Your notes on the town were haunted AF, which is, we always say that. But in this case, it looked charming and haunted. I wasn't afraid. It looked idyllic.
Idyllic. Yeah.
And haunted.
There was also a sense of restless spirits there for sure.
True.
For sure.
It felt like a cute little pioneer town.
Well, let me tell you a little bit about Galena, Maryland.
I would love to hear it.
It is a charming little spot tucked away in Kent County on Maryland's upper eastern shore. It dates back to 1763. Now, back then, it was originally called Downs Crossroads, named after William Downs, who was a popular tavern owner in town. But over time, the name morphed into Georgetown Crossroads, and then, finally, it was named Galena in 1858, after a type of silver that was once mined there.
Cool.
Here's the thing about Galena. You can kayak and fish, and there are a lot of little antique shops and restaurants, so it's super cute. We loved the vibe, and we wished that we had more time to spend there.
It did seem like we were missing something, having to leave so soon. Like I said, Jen was pulled to the south, but we had to go back to the hotel room. It was getting dark.
Well, we did find something when we went through the research.
I cannot stress to you guys enough the trigger warnings on this story. This is probably the most horrific story. It really just scares me that this actually happened. Not only that this actually happened, but how we do not all know about it is insane to me. Okay, Jennifer, tell me about one William Cosden.
Right. The horrific events that you're referring to surround the family of a man named William Cosden in 1851.
Who is he? What do we know?
William Cosden was born around 1820, and he was a farmer's son, and he spent most of his life on his father Jeremiah's farm. And he grew up near what is known today as Chesterville, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
In 1845, he met the love of his life, Marianne Webster. And about that time, he began working the farm about 1 mile east of Georgetown Crossroads.
The former name of Galena.
And William and Marianne began raising a family.
They had a little girl, her name was Mary, and then they had a baby boy whose name was lost to history.
That's right. Now, they lived on a property that was called Moody Farm, once owned by a man named Robert Moody. And Moody had built a two-story brick house on the land in about 1798. And Cosden was renting it in 1851, and he and his family lived there.
What was it about William that drew attention to him to be the victim of a horrific crime?
That's an interesting question, Jill. William Cosden was described as a most worthy and industrious and highly respected young farmer. Mm. And he was also described as a quiet man. Now, he was a good farmer, but he wasn't necessarily extraordinary, and he wasn't wealthy. He grew corn, and he had horses and cows and beehives,
oh,
a carriage and a wagon. And he lived in the house, which was nicely furnished with the basics.
Yeah.
Crockery in the kitchen, a kitchen table and chairs, bedstands and different furniture. But this was not a mansion, and he was not a rich man.
Got it. So there's absolutely no reason that we can think of that would make him an ideal victim of a crime, such as the ones that we are going to describe.
Correct. He's just a regular farmer.
He's just a regular farmer. He's not living the flashy life.
No.
He's a nice guy.
He's a quiet man. Yes.
He's not mouthy. He has a nice young family.
Hardworking. Right.
So now, tell me about the thing that happened that changed life for the Cosden family.
Mm. The date was February 27th, 1851, and William Cosden and his family were found brutally murdered in their home.
It was a chilly night, and William was at home, but he had a full house. He had all kinds of visitors. His sister Amanda was visiting. His wife was home with their two children, his three-month-old baby boy, and his four-year-old daughter, Mary. Also, he had his in-laws with him. So Mary Ann's sister, Rebecca, who was sick, she was laying down upstairs, and Mary Ann's little brother, Dickinson. And everyone just enjoyed a wonderful meal and two enslaved women cleaning up the kitchen. We had William smarking up a smoke next to the fireplace where his baby boy laid in a cradle. And little did they know, four men right outside the front door were waiting for the perfect moment to ambush and change life forever.
Just as the clock struck 7 o'clock, one of the men took a shot at William through the window from the porch ledge. William was hit and fell to the floor. Mary Ann, William's wife, was in the room with him, as well as 16-year-old Amanda, William's sister. And when the shot was fired, they screamed and ran to the corner of the room. Mm. But the men on the porch beat down the locked front door, and they entered. And upon entry, one of the men shot the women in the corner of the room. Amanda died instantly. But despite the bullet that had hit her, Mary Ann tried to run, and she made a break for it, running outside past the men into the yard. But her escape was short-lived because she was shot again and collapsed onto the snowy ground. And as she lay there in the snow, one of the attackers approached and stabbed her twice in the chest.
My God.
Then he mercilessly yanked her earrings out of her ears and pulled the rings off of her fingers.
In that chaos, Mary Ann's little brother, Dickinson, who was there, he saw a chance to run, and he ran successfully out of the house and off the property. He ran all the way into the nearby town of Georgetown's Crossing, now we know it as Galena, and he was the first to sound the alarm.
Right. But in the meantime, one of the men sauntered into the kitchen, and he stumbled upon an enslaved woman. She had been in the kitchen ironing, but when she heard the loud bangs of the gunshots, she attempted to make a break for it. But as the man barged in, he fired on her. She was hit in the back, and her wrist was shattered. But fueled by adrenaline, she got out the back door and she bolted across 3 fields. She climbed over fences. She dashed across a creek bed to Crouch's place. Now, Crouch was her owner. She ran 3/4 of a mile away, wounded and bleeding, and then told him what had happened.
And so when this poor woman barges into his house, bleeding from the back and the wrist is shattered by gunfire, what does he do?
He didn't believe her.
He didn't believe her.
What did he believe her?
What did he think? What did he think? It was a practical joke?
I don't know. He didn't believe her at first, but then he did.
Well, good for him. Back at the farm, Jennifer, what's happening?
Back at the farm, another of the men walked up to the body of Amanda Cosden, William Cosden's 17-year-old sister, and stabbed her twice in the chest, just because.
I know you're probably thinking, how can this get any worse? And yet, here we go. The man, after he stabbed her twice, in front of her dying brother, tries to have his way with her dead body. Then, that same sick fuck, once he got bored with that, barged upstairs to investigate what was happening on the second floor.
Right. Rebecca Webster, Mary Ann's sister, also around 17 years old, was bedridden and weak and had been in bed for a while. But upon hearing the chaos downstairs, she got out of bed and went and hid in a closet. Eventually, she mustered the courage to come out when she heard 4-year-old Mary, who had come upstairs in fear. And the older girl, Rebecca, instinctively locked the door and hid with Mary. But the assailant, having had his fill of the horrific scene downstairs, stormed into the bedroom, pushed aside the terrified little girl, and made for Rebecca.
My God.
He screamed at her, demanding cash that he assumed was hidden in the house. Rebecca obediently pointed to a trunk under her bed, and she confessed that there was $4 in that trunk. Now, $4 is about $160 today.
Can you even imagine?
No, I can't. He yanked out the trunk, and he went through it, throwing things everywhere, but he couldn't find it, and it only pissed him off.
You know, if he wasn't such a dick and like thrusted open the trunk and was throwing stuff around, I bet he would have found his $160.
But he couldn't find it. And that's when he lost it completely. And he attacked Rebecca. Mm. They tussled.
Bedridden or not, she was going down with a fight, which makes me very proud of her.
And then, enraged, he fired at her repeatedly through the bed covers that she had been wrapped in.
Later, she was found with multiple chest shot wounds and her arm gruesomely mutilated by the shots. During the commotion, Jill, the black powder set the bed covers alight and the bed caught on fire.
I just can't. I don't have enough horrific vocabulary words to even describe the way that I feel. It's just, ugh. So what did this sick fuck do next?
The murderer then dashed back down the stairs to check in with the rest of his crew. He spotted William Cosden on the floor, battered, bullet-ridden, and stabbed, but he noticed that he was still hanging on, so he walked up to him and stomped on his head.
How long did this horror show go on for?
The horrific assault on the family went on for more than 2 hours. But amidst this chaos, Dickinson Webster, Mary Ann's 14-year-old brother, had successfully reached Georgetown Crossroads, which was the name of Galena at the time.
He must have been a little chubby kid, because it took him that long to get everything together.
And also, Crouch, the owner of the female enslaved woman, he wasn't far behind. And together, between Crouch and Dickinson, they rang the alarm bell in town, and a cavalry of local folks saddled up and galloped towards the farm.
And did they capture the men?
Oh, Jill, they just missed the intruders by a hair. They had skedaddled just minutes before the posse showed up.
I just don't understand why they had free rein for 2 hours. That's what I don't understand. That's why I said he's a little chubby kid, because it takes like 20 minutes to walk a mile.
I don't know.
Do you know what I mean? Like, what possibly could have taken that long? And I feel bad for the enslaved woman, because do you think it took her like an hour to convince her owner that there's a problem as she's bleeding?
I don't know.
Ugh. So who were these men? What do we know?
Okay. Who were the perpetrators of this horrific crime?
And what in the actual fuck were they doing? Because all I know from what you described is that the only thing they got out of this torture was Mary Cosden's jewelry.
The mastermind of this crime was a man named Abraham Taylor.
What do we know?
He was a man with a chip on his shoulder and a bone to pick with the world. You know the type. He thinks the world owes him.
Mm-hmm.
He had been out of the Maryland penitentiary for about 5 years at the time of the crime. And he had been locked up for stealing and selling a slave.
Do we know how long he was in the penitentiary?
Wasn't it 7 years, Jill?
Yes, it was 7 years. I will say this. It's not a good place.
The penitentiary isn't a good place.
It's not a good place. It's not a good place. So I can understand being like really screwed up from that experience, but he wasn't exactly a good guy before he went into the penitentiary. But it was because of his 7 year stint that he was all angry and thought that the world owes him everything.
Well, he felt that the state of Maryland owed him $7,000 from his time in the penitentiary.
According to a journalist, you know his name, Jen. What's his name?
Kevin Hemstock.
According to Kevin Hemstock, who had written about this mass murder extensively throughout the years, had mentioned in one of his articles that Taylor was said to be schizophrenic. Now, Kevin is the only person that I read that information from, and I did email Kevin a bunch of questions that I had about this story that he had written so much about, but I have yet to receive an email back. So
Kevin, if you're listening, please email us.
Okay. Where was he from? What else do we know about him?
Abraham Taylor was living a gritty existence. He was a laborer. He was often found making some money wood chopping. So he was kind of living hand to mouth, but he also had a drinking problem. Mm. And the money that he could make was barely enough to supply him with the whiskey that he needed.
Jeez.
He was living with a store owner in the town of Coldwell, Delaware, even though he had a family nearby in Blackbird. But his family was not on his mind at all. What he wanted was cash. He wanted fast cash.
Well, I would say he probably did his family a favor that he was bunking with the store owner, because he sounds like a friggin' mess.
Right.
Even picturing him, I just get like the smell of like sweat and grossness.
Right. And so it was Abraham Taylor who concocted this plan to rob a family and make way with the riches and then disappear.
Okay, so Taylor had his plan, but he needed assistance. What'd he do?
He did. Well, he enlisted the help of 45-year-old waterman named Nicholas Murphy. Now, Abraham Taylor was about 50 years old, and so Murphy was similar in age, and he was also kind of a hustler, struggling to support his wife and five kids.
Five kids, my God.
So he was very open to the idea of robbing a wealthy farmer and making away with some loot.
And Nicholas Murphy lived with his family in Bohemia Ferry, and he knew a gentleman named William Shelton. Tell me about him.
Now, William Shelton was in-laws with Nicholas Murphy. Now, unlike Nicholas Murphy and Abraham Taylor, William Shelton was a younger man. Mm-hmm. He was single and he was only 24 years old.
Wow.
But we will see that he was particularly sadistic and ruthless.
Okay.
He had a job at Vochel's Mill near Bohemia Ferry.
Well, he's the only one with employment.
With steady employment.
Yeah.
It would seem so. Now, lastly, there was one more man in on this crime.
Who that?
That was a man named Stephen Shaw.
Okay. And what do we know about Stephen?
Stephen Shaw was also an older gentleman of 45 years old. He was a neighbor of Murphy's, and he was the wild card in the group. He was kind of a last-minute addition. He was an alcoholic, and he too led a hand-to-mouth existence and just did odd jobs whenever he could when he was sober.
Got it.
He was married and had an 8-year-old son.
Oh, wow.
Now, Abraham Taylor, the mastermind, drew up the sinister scheme with Shelton and Murphy. And the idea was very simple. Under the cover of darkness, they would raid one or two houses in Kent County, Maryland, make off with all the cash they could find and all of the prized possessions, and then vanish.
This is the thing, though. Why did he rob William Cosden and their family? Because it doesn't seem like he has a lot of money to spare.
Exactly. For some reason, Abraham Taylor incorrectly believed that William Cosden had recently come into some money, about $800, from a property transaction.
Wow.
But it wasn't true. There was no property transaction and there was no $800. And William Cosden didn't have a lot of money in the house.
And to be completely honest with you, from the way you described the attack on this family, didn't look like they were particularly really ransacking the house. They seemed more preoccupied with killing the people. If your motive actually is to get money, you wouldn't be chasing after the victim. You would be looking in the house for money.
I mean, they were there for 2 hours. I assume they were ransacking the house. We don't know what they actually got out of that house, but there was no big pile of cash. They were expecting $800 in cash, which was a significant sum at the time.
Even the way we described the 17-year-old girls being assaulted, even to me, again, it seems less like a motive for money and more you just being a sick fuck.
I would agree with that.
Okay, so tell me, a week before
the horrifying events, William Shelton, 24 years old, known for his chilling indifference, bought a brand new shotgun in Smyrna, Delaware, and he was spotted casting his own bullets for his firearms.
If someone is known to have a chilling indifference, that is what I would call a red flag.
You think?
Mm-hmm.
He also had a deadly dirk, which is apparently a knife.
And he was showing that dirk off to the ladies. What happened?
He was the kind of person that would just jokingly whip it around and be like, look at my big knife.
Oh, that's pathetic. Okay.
That's another red flag, right?
Yeah.
His neighbor, Eliza Ford, saw him flaunting his knife and said to him, that's not a gentleman's knife. And his reply was, it's a man's knife.
So I know. Sick.
So nasty.
Gross.
Meanwhile, Abraham Taylor also had a double-barrel shotgun and Nicholas Murphy managed to borrow a shotgun from a neighbor. So they were well armed for this crime.
Okay, now they're armed. What does Shaw do? Because he's the wild card. He comes up in the rear. What does he have?
Right. According to Shaw, he had been kept in the dark entirely about the plan to murder the family.
Wow.
He maintained that murder was not initially part of the plan.
So did he have any weapons on him? No, right?
He did not have any weapons on him.
Okay.
Shaw did not arm up for this. He showed up for the money. Per Shaw's own confession, he said that Taylor told him that he'd give him cash and it was easier than earning it.
Taylor also seemed pretty insistent to convince Shaw to be part of this crime. I don't know why, but it feels like he felt outnumbered with Shelton and Murphy.
Yeah.
That he wanted someone to have his back. That's what it seems like to me.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if that's the case, because all I know is that he was really hyper-focused on Shaw being a part of this.
Hang in there, guys. We'll be right back.
Hi, everyone. We are so excited to unveil the first book in our series entitled Common Mystics Present Ghost on the Road Volume 1, Murders and Mysterious Deaths.
It's everything you love about Common Mystics and more.
It's a retelling of 10 of our favorite stories from our pod with exciting extras.
Extras like souvenirs, what we took away from the experience, and what to know if you go, if you decide to travel in our footsteps.
Pre-order the Kindle edition now. All other formats of the book will be available for purchase at Amazon.com on July 1st, 2023.
Thanks, guys. Now back to the show.
So even though Shaw would say that he didn't know about the murderous intent behind Taylor's plan, there is some indication that he did know.
Okay, what would that be?
He apparently wrote a letter to his neighbors, the Browns, suggesting that Taylor plotted to murder the Cosden family. The letter said, "He's planning to kill them tonight and wants me to assist him. Because you're my friends, I'm warning you, or you'll be his next targets. The man's name is Abraham Taylor."
Oh, God.
So apparently Shaw did know and wrote this to his friends.
Why wouldn't he go to the police? My God.
Apparently, he wanted money for booze. All right. So Thursday, February 27th, 1851 comes. It's the day of the murder. 24-year-old Shelton was conspicuously absent at work that day at the mill.
He took the day off.
He did. He did not go to work that day. Instead, he was seen cleaning his guns with Murphy. And they casually mentioned to folks around that they were going off to hunt muskrats.
Okay.
But instead, they crossed the Bohemia River in a small rowboat and headed towards the meeting place where they would meet with Taylor.
Okay.
Now, Taylor, armed with shotguns and a quart of whiskey to convince Shaw to continue on with him.
He was like hanging whiskey from a string and leading him along.
As dusk approached, Shaw purportedly expressed his concerns, asking where they were going and how long they were going to be out. And Taylor casually replied, "We'll get there and back before supper time." Shelton and Murphy were surprised that Shaw had come along with Taylor.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. But there was no turning back. It was a black night with no moonlight. And in this darkness, they navigated the fields towards William Cosden's rented farm.
Taylor was at the helm, and he was excited as they got to the Cosden residence.
He was brimming with anticipation because this was the moment that he was waiting for to finally settle the score for years of torment that he had been subjected to, that he had endured in the grimy, disease-infested prison in Baltimore, Maryland.
I don't know. Maybe don't be involved in the slave trade. I don't know what to tell you.
It was Taylor who stood on the porch, glanced through the window, and fired at William Cosden in his living room. Then Taylor tried to enter through the front door, but it was locked. So it was young Shelton who stepped up and beat the door down with his newly purchased shotgun.
Wow.
Then the men burst through the door, firing at Marianne and Amanda. It's unclear if Shelton or Taylor was the shooter upon entry, but both of them were in the house wreaking havoc. Murphy then followed the men inside, but Shaw,
He was frozen outside, afraid. According to him, that's when he realized that it wasn't just a robbery, but they intended to murder the family. When Marianne ran outside past him into the night, Taylor followed after her, delivering the final death blows to Marianne outside. It was Murphy who had run into the kitchen while Shelton further desecrated Amanda's body, and before Shelton ran up the stairs to confront the sick Rebecca. When the rest of the chaos ensued, Shaw, who had been frozen outside, drunk on whiskey, passed out in a field next to the house.
I do think that little tidbit is a little tiny bit amusing, just that, like, now that all chaos is happening, that he was like, oh, the jug is free, took the jug and went into the field and got drunk. Little tiny bit.
It's kind of amusing.
Kind of.
After they had ransacked the house, the crime in total took over 2 hours. In the aftermath, it was Henry Mitchell, a posse member, who was the first to step foot into the house. And what he found was William Cosden teetering on the brink of life, with his hand still absently rocking the baby's cradle in a bid to keep the little one calm.
Oh my God.
When he saw Henry Mitchell enter the house, he said, "Step inside, please, for heaven's sake. I'm the only one left breathing here." And then he pleaded for Mitchell to protect his baby.
Did William know who did this? Did he recognize any of the men?
He told Mitchell that he didn't know who had done this and said, "I can't for the life of me think I've got a nemesis out there."
God. I have nemesises, but my God, I mean, this is pretty...
This is next level.
Yeah.
William Cosden would die about 30 minutes later.
Was there anyone still breathing in the house?
Yes, he was wrong. His sister-in-law, Rebecca Webster, upstairs was still breathing, despite being bloodied, burned, and beaten. And little Mary Cosden, she was scared, but otherwise unharmed.
The baby did survive the night, but later in the June of that same year would pass away.
Now, the Kent News reported in its March 1st edition of the incident that the carpet, floor, beds, etc. are saturated with blood, and even now the stoutest heart cannot look upon the scene without starting a tear. Two local doctors were called to the scene, but honestly, there wasn't much that they could do for Rebecca Webster.
I mean, this poor girl. She was beaten, burned, shot. My God.
Sadly, she passed away just a couple days later.
I would almost say mercifully she passed away.
Now, news spread and caused quite a stir among the people in the county.
I'm sure.
Everyone was talking about the crimes, and their outrage rippled out from the community and swept over the entire state of Maryland. In fact, in less than 7 days, the governor of the state issued a $1,000 reward for anyone with information that could help nab the culprits. The Cosden family had awake the Sunday following the tragic events, and a sea of people attended the viewing at Jeremiah Cosden's house to pay their respects.
Including
the suspects.
That's some ballsy ass shit right there.
Taylor, Shelton, Murphy, and Shaw.
I will say this, though. It's typical, from my understanding from the crime shows I watch, for like the perps to go to the funeral to look at their handiwork.
Is it?
Yeah.
William Cosden, Rebecca Webster, and Dickinson Webster, and the enslaved woman were all able to provide their accounts of what happened and what the assailants looked like. So even William, who died 30 minutes after he was discovered, and Rebecca, who would die a few days later, were able to give their account of the events, as well as Dickinson and the enslaved woman. And that would lead to the arrest of the men.
Well, a woman stepped forward to provide a telling tip to the investigators.
That's right.
Her name was Mary Hand. What did she do?
Well, she was landlady to Stephen Shaw. Remember Shaw, the alcoholic, the last-minute add-on to the plan?
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, Shaw couldn't keep it to himself and confessed that he had been involved in the saga.
Oh, my God.
And he implicated Taylor, Shelton, and Murphy.
So what happens?
24-year-old Shelton was tried first. He pled not guilty. After hearing both sides of the testimony, it took a jury 58 minutes to deliver a guilty verdict. Abraham Taylor's trial kicked off soon after on June 17th, and guess what? It turned out just like Shelton's. 2 days later, on June 19th, the jury in Cecil County decided his fate. He was guilty of first-degree murder.
It only took them 15 minutes to come to that conclusion.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. That's what I was just going to ask you. And then Jennifer Murphy, what happened there?
Same thing for Murphy. Guilty and sentenced to hang. Now, Shaw was not tried.
Okay, why was that?
Shaw turned state evidence and therefore did not stand trial.
You know, I feel like Shaw should have got some kind of punishment because there are so many opportunities for him to give someone a heads up, right? He wrote his friends to be like, Abraham's going to try to kill you. Why didn't he go to the police? Why not that night when instead of drinking in the field with the jug of whiskey, why didn't he go into town and try to get somebody?
It's true.
You see what I mean? I feel like he should have had more of a consequence to this.
I question his story. Most of what we know about the plan comes directly from Shaw, who is implicating the other three and saving himself. So I question the events in terms of the plan.
Gotcha.
But I agree with you. He should have been culpable, but he did not stand trial because of the evidence that he provided.
Just as we go through the timeline, it seems like the whole time I want to shout at Shaw to be like, do something.
Right.
Call somebody.
The three men, Taylor, Murphy, and Shelton, were sentenced to death via the gallows. It was June 24th in the packed Kent County courtroom when all three villains stood in front of the audience. As the room fell eerily silent, each one was asked, why shouldn't the law take its course? Shelton, nonchalant, countered with, can't say much really, except I wasn't on the scene and I haven't the foggiest idea about it.
Wow.
I know. Play dumb.
Well, not only play dumb, but like, this is horrible. You know yeah. what I'm saying? Like, to be like, you know what? I think whoever did do this crime should be hung. It just wasn't me.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Now, Taylor Abraham, the mastermind, he said, I'm as innocent as that little dude over there, pointing to a child amongst the spectators.
He didn't actually say dude.
Oh, he didn't?
No, he said, I'm as innocent as that little child.
This is Jill. Speak. Jill. When Jill does the outline, things like this just show up. I never know.
Maybe I should have took out the quotes. Okay, go on.
And Murphy? Murphy said, Shaw spouting lies didn't speak a word of truth. I'm not guilty. I swear I don't have any involvement in this.
And then they moved the platform from under their feet and they hung.
All three were hanged, yes.
All three. In August, no less, which is just a couple weeks after being convicted, which is kind of speedy.
That is kind of speedy.
Nowadays, you're on death row for quite a bit. So, Jennifer, I'm assuming that everywhere in the history of Kent County, these events are detailed.
You know what? This is known as the only mass murder that ever occurred in Kent County, Maryland. And so as I was looking through the older articles, I found a history of Kent County, Maryland, 1630 to 1916, which was published in 1916. And I really thought it was going to be a jackpot. I thought, all right, this history is definitely going to talk about the murders and people's reaction to the murders. But I was wrong. It doesn't talk about the murders at all. You know what it does talk about? The carnival atmosphere surrounding the hanging of the three men.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It talks about the troops who accompanied them to the gallows and the 8,000 people who attended the hanging, many of them who had camped out the night before so they could all be there at daybreak for the big event. Yeah.
I just feel like society as a whole is godless after this story. What I would have wanted to know from a historian is how the citizens of the community changed after this aftermath. Like
how they were affected emotionally. Mm-hmm. How did life go on knowing that poor William Cosden and his family had been murdered for a couple of earrings and some rings? Right? And maybe some odds and ends that had been picked up from the house.
Yeah.
Like, how did people respond to that?
How do you even gallop past the house? We know from other research that the house was there for quite a bit.
Yes.
But the way that this story affected generations of people living in that area, that would have been interesting to know.
I couldn't find anything on that. But I did find something interesting that I think tells us why we're even talking about this story.
Oh, tell.
According to, again, the author Kevin Hemstock, who wrote a series of articles in 2011 for MyEasternShoreMaryland.com, he writes about a recent survey that had been done in Chesterville Cemetery in Chesterville, Maryland, Jill, which is right near where William Cosden's father had lived and had a farm.
And where William grew up.
Yes. Now, radar located the remains of 64 people in that cemetery in unmarked graves. What's interesting about this is that the survey was funded solely by one Chesterville resident named John Leisinger, who happens to be the last surviving member of the Chesterville Cemetery Association. And he and the author, Kevin Hemstock, believe that four of the graves found may be those of William Cosden, his wife Marianne, his sister Amanda, and Marianne's sister Rebecca.
Why do they think that?
They think that because the fact that this cemetery is located where William Cosden's father lived, and also the other family members are generally in the area in that cemetery. But no one will ever know unless there's DNA extracted from these remains or if the original survey plot is found. The problem is the original survey plots would be located at the old site Methodist Episcopal Church, which used to be on site, but disappeared to history.
How does that happen?
They don't know what happened to the church that was on site. Nobody knows where it went. The survey of the cemetery plots are also gone.
That is really bizarre.
But so bizarre.
We do know there was a service held for them at that church that has mysteriously disappeared.
That's exactly right.
I don't know. How do you feel about the story?
Well, I believe that one of the reasons that we need to give voice to this family is because I believe these are them, that their remains were found in July of 2021. And they're screaming out to us saying, that's us. That's us. We want to be remembered.
100%.
Their graves deserve to be marked.
100%.
It's not just the carnival of the hanging that should be documented. It should also be the lives of these people who died for literally no reason in the most horrific way. Is there another reason why you think this family deserves a voice?
I agree with everything you just said. This is stuff of nightmares. Like my worst childhood fears times a million. Like this is just the most horrendous thing I have ever had to read. How did we not know this? In a society that we're driven by true crime podcasts and like sensationalism, like how did this family get lost to history?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, we're giving them a voice now.
Jennifer?
Yeah.
We're going to transition out of the sadness that I feel in my heart to talk about our hits and how super psychic we are.
All right. Remind me of our hits.
House of Horrors, Need I Say More?
When I read from the Kent News reported on March 1st, 1851, about the carpet, the floor, the bed saturated with blood, I thought of what you had said in the car about a house of horrors. That newspaper article definitely described a house of horrors.
And the blood crying from the walls like an Amityville horror.
Yes.
Yeah. What about woman crying in a field? I think, do you want to know who I think that is?
Who?
I think it's Marianne.
I think it's Marianne too, because she had run out of the house after being shot.
I don't like it.
I don't like it either. And clearly she was afraid for the safety of her children.
She was probably running to get help. Poor thing.
The gunfire.
Yeah, that's...
that's obvious. Yeah.
Family working on the land, family working on a farm, Jennifer.
Mm-hmm. The Cosdens obviously had a farm.
The rendezvous in the clearing in the woods.
Mm-hmm. Which is where Taylor and Shaw met up with
Murphy and Shelton.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And then that, the little cemetery, the little old man in the cemetery.
Yeah. What significance do you think that had on our story? The fact that we were talking to the caretaker in the cemetery.
Because it was the caretaker in the cemetery of Chesterville in 2021 that was doing the exact same thing the little guy was doing that day when we were driving to there.
Exactly.
When we were driving through Maryland.
Exactly.
And it was having that conversation with us.
It was a metaphor. It was a metaphor for the information that would lead us to the story for sure.
St. Denis Church, Jennifer.
I think the importance of the church is that that old church, the old site Methodist Episcopal Church, has vanished. I think that's the significance of the church. And what about south, Jill? Had we gone south, where would we have been?
We would have ended up at Chesterfield. But I want to tell you this. When you said, let's go south, I told you we won't find anything there. Literally, we wouldn't find anything there.
Because their graves aren't marked.
Yes.
At the Chesterville Cemetery. So oh, I was like, my God.
I didn't know why. And I was the like, church. We're wasting our time.
And the church would have been gone. Mm-hmm. Holy crap. Wow.
We would have just been wasting time for no reason. Spirit was like, you girls need to get back to the hotel.
And that whole Bohemia reference.
Bohemian Ferry. The Bohemian River.
William Sheldon and Nicholas Murphy, both murderers, had come from Bohemian Ferry, and they crossed the Bohemia River to get to the murder site. Wow.
Wow.
I don't even know what to say. I'm kind of impressed this time.
I know, but I hate the story.
I know. I hate the story, too.
I don't even know. Like, it doesn't seem like prayers are even enough for these people. Like, literally, I feel like there should be a GoFundMe to identify those remains. Mary, I will tell you this, and this is a bright spot in our story. Little Mary grew up. She moved in with a distant uncle who lived in Smyrna, Delaware, and she ended up marrying and having a family of her own, and she lived a long life.
So she is the one bright spot in this entire story, that the scared little girl who was in the house for the murder of her family would grow up and live a long, fruitful, beautiful life. So that, let's
goosebumps.
End there. Aww.
I like it.
I love it. Okay, so closing thoughts. Hey, Kevin Hemstock, if you are listening, or if anyone out there knows Kevin Hemstock, the author for MyEasternShoreMaryland.com, hit us up with a message. We would love to talk to you. We have questions.
We have so many questions.
Jill, what are we going to talk about in the detours?
So I was thinking about this. I want to go over some of our impressions and the way that they came up, because there was a lot that was so, there was metaphors. There were so many different kinds of references,
ooh,
right?
All right. I
we
like it.
We have metaphors. We have like literal things, like we won't literally find something there. There's a all lot right. of stuff that we can talk the way Spirit really outdid itself.
All right. I like it. So we're going to talk about our different psychic hits in the detours. So check us out there if you are a member of our Patreon. And if you're not, consider signing up for $5 a month. You will get access to our detours. And we'd love to see you there. Jill, where else can people find us?
Check us out at our website at commonmystics.net. Find us on all our socials at Common Mystics Podcast. Listen in wherever you're hearing your favorite pods.
And don't forget to like, subscribe, and
share.
And share us with your friends. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you.
Good night.